Morning.
Good morning.
Good to be back again. And begin for the recording folks. And one announcement, I understand that tomorrow morning, 4th of July, there will be Bible study, but it will start at 8:45. Is that right? I think that's correct, at least according to the schedule that we've got up there. So if you want to come tomorrow, we'll talk about God and natural disasters. Remember the time. Today, God created the world good but not perfect. And I want to make that claim. It's a question mark in the title, but I want to make that claim. And I'm trying to draw some evidence to demonstrate that the Bible wants to make a comparable claim. Yesterday, however, at the end of the hour, there were half a dozen hands in the air, and I promised we'll return for a few minutes to the conversation yesterday, and maybe it would be good, even for the few that were not here yesterday, to get a capsule summary of what we claim. The most important biblical theological consideration for our environmental issues that we face is God has a special relationship with non-human creatures. That's basic, foundational. And what our environmental considerations must take up is an imitation of God. An imitation of God. To relate to the non-human world as God relates to the non-human world. And we saw from a varying text yesterday that God relates to the non-human world in remarkable ways. God loves the non-human creatures. God even saves, salvation language is used for the non-human creatures. God makes promises to animals. God knows all the creatures. God's got names for all the creatures. What does it mean for God to have a name for every star? Wow. God speaks to the creatures. God listens to creatures. God interacts with these non-human creatures. We've got a remarkable relationship here between God and the non-human creatures. And what are we going to do about that? Is that just going to be irrelevant to us somehow? So what I moved then to a second point is that's basic, that God relationship. Second is what I call a mutuality of vocation. A mutuality of vocation. Human and non-human alike have a vocation here. That's why we explored a little bit why stewardship language ought to be forgotten. We should not use stewardship language for environmental issues. We must use language like partnership, mutual servanthood, language like that. Okay? Now, a key issue here is, so often when we think about environmental considerations, it's what human beings can do to care for the non-human creature. That's the issue for us. And what happens in that way of thinking about things is that the non-human creatures become the object of human activity. And immediately, we're into difficulty. I think that we must think about a mutuality where the vocation goes not only from the human to the non-human, but also from the non-human to the human. And the net effect of such an understanding is that, to put it negatively, first of all, the net effect of a sort of a human-centered understanding of the environmental task is that however environmentally sensitive one may be, this will diminish the place and value of the non-human creatures. They become objects. And so I think it's important for us to think about the mutuality of vocation. And yesterday we talked, used various illustrations from the biblical texts about how the non-human was sort of the savior of the human again and again and again. And at the Red Sea and the wilderness, the ravens feed Elijah, the fish rescues Jonah, even the animals by being used in sacrifice, become a vehicle for the forgiveness of the human. Human and non-human alike, mutuality of vocation. Now, the book of Job is very important here, and we'll weave it back in when we get to the main topic for today. The book of Job is, you get 37 chapters where Job was complaining and his friends are complaining about Job complaining, and then God finally enters the scene in chapter 38, and what does God do? God takes Job out to where the wild things are, out into the creation. I mean, what kind of pastoral counselor act is that? Huh? A lot of commentators have given God a failure. Precisely that point. And I was awakened one day to the point here by a woman, 50 years old perhaps, in one of my classes. And she talked about the fact that her husband, a couple of years earlier, had committed suicide. And she was struggling to come to terms with this reality in her life. And she had drawn on various resources that the church was able to offer. She said the pastors were very helpful, the congregational colleagues were helpful. But she said the breakthrough in her recovery was when her sons took her into the wilderness areas of northern Minnesota for 2 weeks. And that close touch with God's majestic creation, if you will, enabled a new sense of the goodness of God's work in the world, a renewed sense of God's wonder-filled creation, and this brought finally healing to her. The vocation goes both ways. And it's important that they be recognized in comparable terms. Well, that's together some material from yesterday. There were some questions. Does anyone still have? Yes, please.
For me, it's important to know a little bit more about your dislike of the word stewardship. I've always been pretty comfortable with it because I've used it the way you're using service and partnership and such, and our church uses it in some very creative ways. So I guess I'm wondering whether you see the core word itself as being inadequate or inappropriate here, or whether it's just more that the word has been so misused that you prefer to leave it and go to other terms.
It may be a combination of that. I wonder, stewardship language in the church is probably used more often with relationship to money than anything else, and hence the language has associations which refer to things. Mm-hmm. And non-creatures, if you will, except in a very extended sense.
And our church changed that pretty dramatically about 20 years ago and moved beyond that money concept.
Yeah, right. But it's still there, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the general understanding of stewardship. Another issue here has to do with what I would call stewardship language perpetuates a certain hierarchy of valuation, so that you get God, the human, and the non-human. And it's hierarchy. These texts don't go in the direction of pyramid or hierarchy. They want to level the playing field. Human beings don't have a day where they're created all by themselves. They're created on the same day as the animals. So we need to find language somehow that levels the field in significant ways. Not absolutely. Human beings have a special role, just as certain animals have a special role. But I think stewardship language doesn't enable us very well to level the field here. I think also you get to thinking about a list of do's and don'ts commonly in with the language of stewardship, and even a sort of a moralistic or legalistic sense of things. That's not as helpful as it might be. So I want to lift up the more positive elements that I laid out initially. Can we find language that best conveys God's relationship to the human, God's special relationship to the non-human creature, and this mutuality of vocation? What language best serves that key biblical witness? And I read the scholarship these days, they're moving away fast from the language of stewardship here. And I think we need to pay close attention to what that's about.
And I assume the book covers this fairly well, that I can bring that back to our congregation, and a dozen of us or so can do some thinking about that.
If you take a look at the last chapter in this book, the discussion occurs.
Okay, good.
With references to further discussion.
Yeah, well, I think however we continue to use the word, being able to look at that and think about that in our experience here will be helpful for our congregation.
And an ELCA pastor, Paul Santmyer, as I mentioned yesterday, his work is crucial here. In fact, somebody was asking me yesterday about the article that he wrote. He's written several books, The Travail of Nature, so forth. But he's got the key article on this issue is in Christian Scholars Review, I'd say maybe 2000, 2001, the reference is in my book. And the article, very interesting title of the article is Partnership with Nature According to the Scriptures, : Beyond the Theology of Stewardship. And Santmyer has, with great deep Lutheran sensitivities, unpacks that very well. Yes, please.
We weren't here yesterday, but is there a distinction drawn between the animal life and plant life, or how are those two treated?
Yeah, there. It's one were to sort of be a botanist or a biologist or whatever, and go after the text in that kind of detail. One could enable. But some distinctions I think could be found there, but one distinction I think that cannot be found, namely God's special relationship to them all. God doesn't see, well, let's say I've got an animal on my hands and, well, I think more of animals than of stars, or something like that. It's God in these texts that we read yesterday range across the sphere of non-human creatures and God's special relationship to them in remarkable equality or equanimity, it's very helpful.
Do you feel that plants are getting as much attention as animals in the current situation?
Well, probably not. I think that's just an outsider's view of the one. And I suggest that, your comments suggest that that is the case. So we'll need to attend to that.
See the farms disappearing, and you see the crops and the people around the world trying to feed themselves and not being able to manage. So I'm just looking at that as feeding the world.
Yeah, helpful. Thank you. Anything else before we move on here this morning? Well, if you want to come back to it, we'll come back to it, or come up to me afterwards, and or tomorrow. We've got another day together. God created the world good, not perfect. Now, good, some quick definitions here. The word good includes the aesthetic considerations, beautiful. Includes considerations of intentionality, namely that the creation corresponds to the divine intention. It includes the elements of purposefulness. So it's a complex word and cuts across quite a spectrum of consideration. On the other hand, I'm going to say not perfect. You look up the word perfect in the dictionary and you get a variety of angles on this. So the way in which I'd like to use it, which I think is the typical use of the language, is that without defect or without inadequacy or in no need of development to be what it was created to be. And that would be the language that I would want to Figure out what's going on here. Or in other terms, if the creation were perfect, how could anything go wrong? Well, something went wrong. And we need to think about that. Now, let me just list some arguments here, some biblical evidence, if you will, for seeing the world as good but not perfect. First, the word subdue. Right out of the chute, first words to the newly created human beings, God says, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. If the world's perfect, what would need to be subdued? This subdue language, people have struggled with its meaning a little bit because, you know, what's the implication of this? It may have reference to cultivation, some people think. Difficult task in those days. Some people have done a word study. The word's not used very often in the Old Testament, about 10 times. And in the other context where the word is used, it is used always for human activity against other humans. And that is commonly a negative, so that in the holy war context, for example, human beings subdue other human beings, and that's negative for sure. Okay? But nowhere else in the Bible are non-human creatures subdued. So we got to be careful not to simply transfer the reference from human, it's used in a human context, to a non-human context. Another thing to keep in mind here is that this language of subdue is pre-sin. So that whatever subdue is here, it doesn't have a sinful context in which it is being understood. It's a positive word, in other words. It's got to be a positive word in that kind of context. So what might it mean for the creation to be subdued? Well, the way in which I've tried to come to terms with this is, it needs unpacking, and we'll try to unpack it a little bit, is subdue means to bring order out of continuing disorder. To bring order out of continuing disorder. See, God's creation is understood to be a long-term project. A long-term project. It's going someplace. And we need to talk about the becoming of creation. That the becoming of the creation is built into the very structures of God's world. And it involves, as we've seen, the not simply God, but other creatures. And I think the implication is, and the understanding is, that the world would look quite different eventually than it did at the end of the seventh day. That seems to be what is involved. It's interesting that if you take a, be fruitful, multiply, do the earth, so forth, if you use the language of natural law for that, and you have to be careful with that language of natural law, if you use that language for this, it's deeply ironic that a natural law would be put in place so that the created order would not remain the same. There's an irony there that's really quite remarkable, I think. A second piece of evidence has to do with chapter 2 of Genesis. Beginning with verse 18, and let me just read these verses 18 to 20 and get that before us. Then the Lord God said, okay, God speaking, perhaps to the divine council, like in 1:26. The Lord God said, it's not good that the man should be alone. What do you mean, God? You just got done saying all through chapter 1, it's good, it's good, it's very good, and now you're coming around and saying it's not good? What is this? It's not good that the man should be alone, and I'll make him a helper as his partner. And so out of the ground the Lord God formed every animal of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called, whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the air and to every animal of the field. But for the man, there was not found a helper to be his partner. Now, this is a very interesting text with all sorts of implications. Not as as thoroughly dealt with by commentators as it should be, I think. Here God catches up the human in the creative process. Human is given the task of determining whether the animals will be a satisfactory resolution to the problem of aloneness. Now notice, you got aloneness in a pre-sin situation. There's a suffering issue here. Aloneness. And the human being is given the authority to decide whether the animals will advance the situation from not good to good. Now, let's pause for a minute here and think about the image of God. It's presented here and elsewhere in the opening chapters of Genesis. Again, not very commonly developed. The image of God here is God is an evaluator. God is an evaluator. And again, evaluates the creatures as good, quite apart from any usefulness that they may have for the human. And this valuation of God, it's God-given. It's not something that all human beings might think or feel about the situation. It's good. God says so. Francis Watson, who's a British scholar, he's got a number of important sort of books on hermeneutics, he's got a book in Text, Church, and World. And here's a striking sentence, I think, with regard to the evaluative work of God. Human acts which treat the non-human creation simply as the sphere of use value or market value, refusing the acknowledgement of its autonomous goodness, are, and this is written pre-9/11, are acts of terrorism in direct opposition to the intention of the Creator. Very strong language, and right on target. Declaration of goodness as reference to every creature here.
Would you read that again?
Francis Watson, Text, Church, and World, pages 146 and 147. Human acts which treat the non-human creature simply as the sphere of use value or market value, refusing the acknowledgement of its autonomous goodness, are acts of terrorism in direct opposition to the intention of the Creator. Remarkable statement coming from the British side of this conversation. Now, continue to think a little bit about God as an evaluator here. What does it take to be an evaluator? It means that God does not remain distant from what has been created, sort of uninvolved somehow or unaffected. In order to evaluate, God has to experience, in some sense, that which has been created. God has to experience it. God has to be affected by what's been creation, by what's been created. Good. Well, let's see. That experience will shape God's evaluation. So you have then an ongoing relationship of God to each of the creatures. And God knows the situation so well that God can determine whether or not it's good or not good. That takes an involvement level of God here. And God is affected by this. There's a deep sense of the affectability or the affectivity of God here. Now you may say, why in the world would God need to evaluate God's own work? Wouldn't it automatically be good? Wouldn't you just take for granted that it's good? I think a clue here is that this language is testimony to a creative process rather than a punctiliar event. You get a creation, and then you get the one who creates backing off a little bit and evaluating what's been created. That's testimony to process, not a punctiliar event. And then you get this statement in 2:18:20. It's not good, God says. It's not good. Something that God has done is not good. At least, yeah. And then you get the engagement in the text with the red of the human in the task and evaluation. God here, I think, sets a key human task into place that human beings are called to advance the situation, to participate at least in the advancement of the situation from not good to good. Now, it's striking, isn't it? That the first move God makes to take care of human aloneness is to create animals. What's God doing here anyway? Might God be genuinely thinking that the animals would in fact solve the problem? Is this, I don't know any way to say this, is it a kind of trial and error move for God? It proves not to be a final decision, but God's move must at least, I think, mean that the animals are understood by God to constitute a community that could meet the issue of aloneness. Let me repeat that. I think that's important. God's move must, initially the animals, must mean at least that the animals are understood by God to constitute a community that could meet the issue of human aloneness. God gives here the animals a very high value. Now, how God responds here. God brings these animals before the human being, one by one. First all the animals, and then the woman. And twice, God lets the human being determine whether the animals, and then the woman, are adequate to meet to make the move from not good, good. The human being decides what fits for him, not God. It's a human decision here. And I'll ask, is not the future of the human race in some basic sense put in the hands of the human? Whoa, do we want that much responsibility? This portrayal of God, the creator of the heaven and the earth, leading, get in your head, leading these animals one by before the man. What are you going to call this one? Rhinoceros? Are you sure? Hippopotamus? God? What is God doing? By bringing these animals one by one before the human being, letting the human being determine what the human being is given the freedom to decide. And so God so values the human freedom that, that God will genuinely interact with that human response with respect to the shaping of the future. Now it's very striking, I think, that the human being doesn't immediately decide, oh God, if you say so, this must be right. The human being doesn't make that kind of move here. The human being objects, or you might say, no, God, that's not right. I mean, here you are, the creator of the heaven and the earth, and what God initially provides, the human, and human freedom does not accept. And then God, in turn, accepts the human decision and goes back to the drawing boards. In other words, God takes the ongoing creational process into account in shaping new directions for the creation. What do you got here? You got divine decisions interacting with human decisions with respect to the creation of the world. Creation is process as well as event. And folks, we're involved. The future is genuinely open here. Depends upon what the human being does with what God presents. Will the human being decide for the animals? In other words, think about, what if the human being had decided for the animals? It's a genuine decision here. And that the human decision will determine, as we know, whether the humanity, whether there will be a next human generation. And so the human decision determines, at least in part, how God is able to move into the future. The human judgment shapes the next divine decision. Now, Phyllis Tribble, who has it's in print now after 30-some years, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, very influential book. She does an analysis of this material in one chapter of that book. She doesn't quite get there, but this sentence is right on target. She says, God is now present, quote, not as the authoritarian controller of events, but as the generous delegator of power who even forfeits the right to reverse human decisions, unquote. Without any qualification in the text, whatever the human being decides, that's the name of the animal. Whatever. Now, isn't it interesting? The human being gives names to the animals. Now, you go back to chapter 1, and there you've got God giving names to creatures. Okay? God names the heavens and the earth and the sky. But God in chapter 1 of Genesis never, ever names a living creature. That is reserved somehow here for the human activity. Now, it's not that, I don't want to make too much of this, but it's not that human beings have the capacity to stymie God's movement into the future in any final way, I think, yes. But God has so established a relationship with the human that their decisions about the creation and its development truly count. They make a difference with regard to the future of creation. And of course, you get in the text that the man sees the woman and in exaltation says, that's it! This is it! And how does that evaluation now of the man, of the woman, function in the text? It's exactly the counterpart of the work of God's evaluation in chapter 1. The human being, in effect, says, this is good. This is good. So, I'm also, just kind of an aside here, I'm struck by the fact that in Adam's response to the woman, there's no mention of procreation. And there's no mention at all of her sexuality. She is another human being. It's very interesting how guarded, I might say, or that text is in this regard. Now, this issue opens up the themes of suffering. And I'd like to just fairly quickly list five issues of suffering. Five issues of suffering that the text presents. We've already got one, or actually two, the language of subdue, and you also got the language of aloneness. that's present here. Now, what are some of the other suffering issues that this text raises? And what I've put on the board here is it's very important how one breaks out the categories of suffering. And just, this is, if you're interested in this, by the way, my wife and I wrote a book entitled Hope in God in Times of Suffering, available from Oxford Portrait. And this is the basic outline. Suffering is becoming. Suffering is the consequence, first of one's own sin, and the consequence of the sins of others. All too often we collapse these. Third, systemic, namely racism, sexism, classism, ageism, and so forth, okay? And then suffering is vocational, and that's, it's a suffering is a vocation of God, and it's a human and a non-human vocation. This suffering is good. These are not, and becoming is more mixed, and we're going to focus on the becoming part. And if you're interested in a little different take than mine on this, you might go to Douglas John Hall's book, God and Human Suffering, Oxford Fortress, still in print after 20 some years. We use it in classes at the seminary. Now, five quick points here of how I think suffering is pre-sin. Human beings are finite. That is to say, they're created with limits. Limits of intelligence, limits of agility, limits of strength, limits of speed. Adam and Eve, before sin, would not have been able to outrace a cheetah. Adam and Eve, before sin, still needed some education. Now, when we stretch those limits, say in education or in sports, we may suffer for the sake of gain. What do we say? No pain, no gain. Or when one or another part of the body in the process here stretches too much, we might say, we may suffer pain. And recall here, I think a little piece of evidence for what we're trying to claim, Genesis 3:16, where God comes to the woman and in the wake of sin and announces that the woman in childbirth shall experience an increase in pain. Not will experience pain, but an increase in pain. In pain. In Spain. Where's that? Spain. Good. And this implies that pain was understood to be a natural part of childbirth before sin was ever into the picture. Only in view of sin now it's intensified. Or when we, say, stretch those bodily limits in climbing, we may suffer. Now, Hall's comment here is very interesting. It's basically, if suffering serves life, then it's good. If suffering serves life, it's good. And it's part of God's intentions for the creation. So as this, listen to a couple of sentences here. It's a long discussion in the book. Life without any suffering would be no life at all. It would be a form of death. Life depends in some mysterious way on the struggle to be. Or this one. If nothing were inaccessible, nothing out of reach, if there were no unfulfilled dreams, or wishes, there would also be no wonder, no surprise, and no gratitude. But at the same time, he says, suffering ought not to be cultivated for its own sake or celebrated. So, a second point here is that God has not created a risk-free world. God has not created a world, a risk-free world. Accidents happen in God's good pre-sin creation, or at least potentially so. If Adam and Eve had fallen from the tree and broken their arm, it would have hurt. Just think about God's creation. Water. Indispensable for life, but dangerous. Or the law of gravity. indispensable for life, for the world, for that matter. But it works every time. It works every time. Or fire. And isn't it a wonderful gift? Isn't pain a wonderful gift in certain situations, particularly when your hand gets too close to the fire? So we may, another interesting angle on this is relating to finitude, maybe more than a risk-free world, not a risk-free world, is sometimes we equate mistakes and sins. It's as if sort of in a pre-sin world, somehow every test we'd get 100. No. We're finite. Limits of intelligence. Don't equate mistakes and sins. So even without sin, suffering is an integral part of God's world, at least potentially so. A third, and this one we're going to get in more tomorrow, is that God has created a dynamic world in which there are such phenomena as these: earthquakes, volcanoes, glaciers, storms, bacteria, viruses. They all have their role to play in the becoming of the world. Okay? And because we're a part of this interconnected world, we may get in the way of these workings of the becoming of the world. Now, sometimes we make it worse for ourselves than we might, and so we build homes way up on the side of Mount St. Helens. What I would call an insufficient attunement to the workings of the world. it's interesting, about 15 years ago, whenever we were here, and they showed a video, I don't know what wasn't the video at that time, but anyway, of the coming earthquake in California. And they had interviews with several people who had purchased homes right on the San Andreas fault line. Why did you do this? Why did you do this? Other than sheer stupidity, why did you do this? And it was remarkable in a couple of instances we heard, well, it must have been the will of God. So in the end, you got somebody at which you can point the finger and blame. But because we then are part of such a world, we may get in the way of its workings. And this is what we need here to make a distinction between natural evil and moral evil. And so it's not, in some ways, not helpful. Moral evil always has human sin as the key factor in ill consequences or negative consequences. Natural evil does not have reference to malevolence on the part of non-human creatures, but it has reference to the effects of non-human creaturely activity. That's natural evil. Okay? And the potential for natural evil was present in the world from the beginning. And you could go to the book of Job here and take maybe just a couple more minutes. Look, very interesting. If you look at the opening chapters of Job, almost all the suffering of Job experiences is because of natural evil. Disease, wind storms, fire, and then it's the Sabaeans and Chaldeans, which are marauders off the desert, and they're really sort of more natural evil than moral evil. And so Job complains about the fact that he hasn't committed any sin to deserve these kinds of things. Well, if it's all natural evil, all people, whether they have committed certain sins or not, are subject to being negatively affected by natural evil. And this can be taken, and so when God comes to Job, and at the end of the book, where does God take Job? God takes Job out into the world, into the natural world. That's the response to Job's experience. Job, you don't have a big enough picture of the world. The world is constructed in such a way that there are all sorts of negative consequences possible in view of the kind of world that God has created. You've experienced them. Wake up! And so we get, Jesus too gets into this once in a while. John 9. Who sinned? This man or his parents? That he was born blind? Neither. Don't make the connection between sin and suffering in every case. Certainly in some cases. But there are many such cases where that connection not to be made. Then in this connection, let me refer to a wonderful little book by John Polkinghorne. If you don't know it, get it, read it. It's gone into multiple reprints. It's entitled Quarks, Chaos, and Christianity. And it's a 100-page book, one of the finest little sort of lay-level considerations of the relationship between science and theology. And listen to this sentence. I'll use him a little further tomorrow. We tend to believe that if we had been in charge of creation, we would have done it better. With a little care, a little more care about the details, we would have kept the beauty of sunsets, but eliminated germs like staph. But the more we understand the processes of the world, the less likely does it seem that this would be possible. Created order looks like a package deal. Exactly, here it comes. Ready for this? Exactly the same biochemical processes that enable cells to mutate, making evolution possible, are those that enable cells to become cancerous and generate tumors. You can't have one without the other. In other words, he says, the possibility of disease is not gratuitous, it's the necessary cost of life. I mean, folks, count on it. Before sin, the potential for cancer was as alive and well as after sin, even though it now has become complicated and human beings can, in fact, bring it on in ways that are more complex. So, even if there had not been sin, disease would have been a reality for human life, only in the new heaven and the new earth. And the new heaven and the new earth, remember, is no return to Eden. Only in the new heaven and the new earth will there be no more tears. Now, fourth and fifth quickly, and then that's what I'm talking about. It's what I would call randomness. The functioning of these creatures of God is orderly in many ways, but randomness also plays a role. And the Bible knows about randomness. And one of the neatest texts to cite at this particular point is in the seldom studied book, in the church at least, seldom studied book of Ecclesiastes. And listen to this text. It's chapter 9, verse 11. And there's something going on here. 9-11, in terms of, listen to Ecclesiastes. Again, I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift. You think so, though, right? Or the battle to the strong. Oh, it should be, shouldn't it? Or bread to the wise, or riches to the intelligent, or favor to the skillful. And then comes the word, time and chance happen to them all. If you've got room in your understanding of God in the world for chance, when I wrote a little article for the Lutheran Woman Today, I used the, on suffering, I used the phrase, the randomness of the gene pool. And I got this gorgeous letter from a grandma in the suburbs of Milwaukee. And she said, thank you for this article. We have a 2.5-year-old severely disabled granddaughter. And we have been agonizing over what we did to deserve this or to occasion this. And she said, all of a sudden your phrase, the lights went on. The randomness of the gene pool. That's the creation with which we're part. And randomness, the scientists tell us, is absolutely indispensable for the proper working of creation. I was working at Christicon last summer, and there was a tall father, 6'6", who had lost a son in the Cascades. He and his wife were up walking, maybe somebody knew him, walking, and he slipped and tumbled over 250 feet to his dead. And how have you come to terms with that event? And he said one word. Randomness. Randomness. That's the way the world works. A fifth point that we won't take long with, but God uses again and again in this world agents to do God's work in the world. And the divine decision to use non-divine agents opens up the world to less than perfect results. And so it's given the finitude of creatures that God chooses, given now in the wake of sin, the sinfulness that God chooses, which is, there is a certain messiness in the way in which God things gets things done in the world. And that messiness in God's relating to human creatures is correspondent to, as we looked at earlier this week, the messiness of the creation in which we have a role to play. Oh, we've got a few minutes here. Questions, comments? Please.
It strikes me that given that we can imagine a better creation, maybe even a perfect creation, it may not even be our idea of everlasting life or the reconciliation of this creation isn't even possible without the creation we're in today. One precedes the other.
And people often wonder, why didn't God start with the first one?
Right.
No, yeah.
Thoughts crossed my mind, so. Yeah.
And I think there's not an easy response. I don't know if I've got a good response to that question. But there is, for some reason, necessary for the world to go through this world before the next world somehow has significance, meaning, content.
And it's hard to perceive that often.
Yeah. And how to break that out is, I think, important. But one of the things you should know, all tuck this away, that in the library, or in heavens, there will be a library. And you're in heaven, you're still going to have to work for knowing more. Okay. Yes, please.
You made the statement that even before sin, man was finite.
Finite, yes.
And where in the Genesis text would you see that coming up?
Well, I think there's sort of two ways at that. Is there anything in the Genesis text that suggests that human being is infinite? No, there's nothing there infinite. But there are some, the way in which God talks to the human being and involves the human being in the naming of the animals and so forth, suggests a kind of finitude. But there's not a sort of list of particulars that one could apply there. At least not that I know.
Well, in the day you eat, you'll die. So if you didn't eat, you wouldn't die.
Yes. So that means that's at least a recognition of finitude. Oh, I see. Yeah, well, that's you're saying the same thing. It's a recognition of finitude in that it can be denied. Yes, please. Yeah.
I would like you to comment more on your use of the word evil when you talked about natural evil and moral evil. I mean, I didn't feel comfortable with that use of the word evil. So I'd like you to say more what you mean by that, because I don't think death and destruction is necessarily evil.
Yeah. I'm going to blame the systematic theologians here for some of this. I think that the language of evil is used in ways that's not always helpful, particularly natural evil. We tend, in our everyday language, we tend to use the word evil for moral evil. So that the 9/11, for example, would be an example of moral evil. And we understand that more clearly. We've all experienced moral evil, and as a community and as individuals. And then the question would become sort of, how do you struggle with natural evil? And then the issue of death is on the scene, and is a long debated issue as to whether or not death was an integral part of the world prior to sin. And so that you would talk about natural evil rather than moral evil. I think my opinion is, this is a big topic, my opinion is that death is both and, not either or, and that that in the wake of sin, death became a very complex reality, and is defined in Genesis 3 primarily in terms of the breakdown of relationships of consequence, namely between God and humans, between the humans, between human beings and the ground, between human beings and the animals, and the breakdown of relationship to one's own self, which is defined in the text as shame. It's right there. Now, those are effects of sin, and those are deathly. So the death then becomes a much more complicated. The wages of sin is death, which may refers to eternal death, perhaps, but the death is a much more complicated reality in the wake of sin. It's interesting. The tree of life is a part of the Garden of Eden, and according to the text, people can continue to live only if they eat of the tree of life. So it's clear that human beings are not created to be mortal.
But I guess to me, there's a difference between I would not call an earthquake or a natural evil, where I would, because it's part of the creative process of the of the earth.
But we're stuck with it.
Right, but a different kind of, I maybe would call a natural evil, mental illness that is organic brain that caused somebody to commit suicide or something like that. If there's some, I don't know.
Well, it depends upon the effects of the earthquake. If it ends up killing a lot of people, there's some sense in which the phrase natural evil becomes pertinent, it seems to me. And what's happened, not altogether helpfully in theological reflection, is that the language of natural evil then is extended to have reference to all such occurrences, even though in a given instance there may not be negative human consequence. One also needs to think also of negative consequence on the non-human. We need to be not entirely anthropocentric. The bell is rung. Tomorrow, God and Natural Disasters, will continue some of this conversation. Thank you very much.